The scientific accomplishments of our time are great. We have a picture of a black hole. We can send people to a space station to live for a year. We know all the base pairs in the human genome. And somehow, we still can't talk about women's periods without somebody feeling embarrassed or worse. The co-editors of Scientific American set out to change that with a special issue called Fertile Ground, the long-neglected science of reproductive health. It gets to many aspects of women's health, both purely scientific and sociological as well. Clara Moskowitz is one of the co-editors of Scientific American. She joins us by phone. Hi, Clara. At least we hope she's there, Clara Moskowitz.
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Jen Schwartz is with us as well. Jen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Hi. This is a return visit for Jen Schwartz. She joined us early last year to try to wrap our minds around blockchain and digital currency. So, Jen, let's start with you. What prompted this special issue of Scientific American?
Sure. So, we started with this one story that came to us about what is the evolutionary purpose of a period? You know, what is the point of bleeding? And how have all of these things that we don't understand about this process led to gaps in understanding when it comes to other issues, whether it's, disorders or diseases of getting periods or just, being a woman and the way that we're treated. And then a lot of us realize there's a lot of topics around this that we don't know enough about and where the science is either incomplete or there's a lack of innovation. So that's how we ended up with four different features on this topic.
Clara Moskowitz, in your perception of science and societal reactions to it, is this the area that seems most fraught in terms of we almost seem to not want to know much or at least, we give it off to like, no, it's best if you know it and we don't, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this whole package started with a kernel of questions, and the more we looked into it, the more we realized that we don't know. Either scientists don't know, the public doesn't know so many basic things about how women's bodies work. And I think, what you said is the part of the reason behind it is that we all have this taboo around periods, this squeamishness that has kind of led people to kind of ignore the topic, both in public life and especially in research and research funding.
So I mean, obviously, this is stuff that's been going on for a very long time, and in fact, even in our society, I know women who've told me that their ex-husbands, notice ex-husband, wouldn't touch them when they were having their period. But it gets worse than that. Clara, how deep do some of the taboos about menstruation go around the world?
Yeah, it's amazing. I'll tell you a little story that actually got left on the cutting room floor and didn't make it into the issue because we had so many good anecdotes about this. But they did one study recently where they had grad students, work on a project that wasn't supposed to be about women's health at all. And they had an actor pretend to be a grad student, and she would either drop a tampon on the floor out of her purse or a hair clip. And they found that her partner, her other grad student research partner, would sit much further away from her in the room if she had dropped the tampon than if she had dropped the hair clip, just showing this basic human tendency to go ew and step back from women who might be having their periods.
And we are talking an unused tampon, correct?
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, just even the idea reminded the grad student that, oh, right, she's a woman, she might be having her period. And I'm sure they didn't have any of those conscious thoughts, but they behaved in a way that gave them distance, that moved them back, that let them escape having to even confront the possibility of getting near period blood.
Wow. I'm thank you for sharing that story that we would not have found in Scientific American. Jen Schwartz, I want to come back to you because you talked about one of the things that started this off was the evolutionary purpose of menstruation. What is that?
So, in the story, we talk about various reasons why humans bleed and so many other species do not. And it's still sort of unknown. There's a lots of different ideas in terms of, the vascular quality of humans compared to other mammals or why the lining is shed every month if it's not used. And it's really interesting. Part of what we looked into in the piece is, when women are on synthetic hormones or the birth control pill for many years, they're not ovulating. And so what does it mean if you're having, 400 or 450 periods in a lifetime versus having far fewer if you're on birth control and you're not actually having a true period? And we don't actually know, some of the answers around that. How does that change our risk of cancers? you know, we do have some information, but it's really incomplete in a lot of ways.
Well, and there's a portion of the work in this issue of Scientific American when you point out too that it's not just about societal responses to science, but the science itself is kind of foggy. Birth control pills given for many maladies appears to be part of this. Can you riff on that a bit?
Sure. So, you know, when it comes to birth control pills, you're really looking at the, you know, sort of different formulations of the same two hormones, or when you're looking at devices such as the IUD or anything that's prescription-based, really, you're not looking at a wide range of options. We sort of have this illusion of choice, but in reality, there's really not much innovation. And so, you know, it's not just for preventing pregnancy. For women who have issues such as PCOS or endometriosis or other disorders that just aren't well studied, doctors often just give the pill as a way to disrupt the cycle so that some of these issues will go away. But it's not necessarily treating the issue itself. And that's where the lack of science, lack of research, but also the lack of funding. You know, a lot of researchers are curious about this, but there's so little funding interest to get these things moved forward.
Lack of funding because it is women's health, lack of funding because it is health, or what do you point that to?
Certainly lack of funding because it is women's health. You know, that's a broader problem in a lot of medical research, is that it is based on, you know, we have men or males being, you know, the center of the study, and there's not a lot of, you know, good evidence of, you know, what happens when you look at women-specific diseases and women-specific issues, and we're just really far behind in a lot of those places.
Jen Schwartz and Clara Moskowitz are the co-editors of Scientific American, which has devoted a single issue to coverage of women's health issues. Fertile Ground, the long-neglected science of female reproductive health. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the issues involved here. They are many, both societal and scientific. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to get into the conversation by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Clara Moskowitz, I mean, with this lack of funding we just talked about with Jen, I mean, there are clearly some gaps when it comes to understanding women's reproductive processes and what can go wrong, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, one glaring issue is endometriosis, which is a hugely common, extremely painful problem. About 1 in 16 women suffers from it, and basically it causes extreme pain either during your period, during other parts of your cycle. And it's because the uterine lining is actually not in the uterus anymore. It starts growing all over other parts of your body. I suffer from this personally, and it's brutal and utterly agonizing. And most people aren't diagnosed for decades because doctors are really unfamiliar with it. They don't tell their patients that they might be suffering from it. And, you know, we don't have any treatments for it except for birth control. As Jen mentioned, you know, it's the one and only pill option we give to anybody with anything going wrong with their uterus. And, you know, it's a very imperfect solution. And endometriosis is just one of many different kinds of problems that women have.
Well, does the birth control pill essentially just tell the women's reproductive apparatus shut up and just go along?
It does, but it doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for some women, the pill does lessen their pain and they're able to kind of live a normal life. But for other women, endometriosis is completely not addressed by the pill. The uterine lining keeps growing outside of the uterus, and they keep feeling the pain from it, and surgery is the only option. And they have to remove all of this growth in your abdomen and all of these lesions and adhesions. And, you know, one of the biggest consequences of this, besides the pain, is infertility. It's a real leading cause of infertility. And partly because it's so underdiagnosed, women suffer with it, and this serious damage is being done to their reproductive systems because nothing has been done to address it for all the years they've been suffering.
Is it underdiagnosed because it's often considered just some sort of cramping or something?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, we have a larger problem in society, and this has been documented, of doctors kind of ignoring and underestimating women's reports of pain. It kind of goes along with these historical ideas of women being hysterical and weak. So when a woman comes to a doctor and says, you know, my periods are really painful, a doctor says, well, that's normal. Your period is supposed to hurt, you know, and they'll say, take some Advil. And the woman, isn't usually taken seriously when she's trying to tell the doctor that her pain is abnormal, is out of the usual. She thinks something is going wrong in her body. And, you know, only now are we kind of able to quantify some of the effects of this and see just how many women's disorders have been ignored because doctors didn't think anything was wrong with them.
Well, particularly with endometriosis then, Clara, do we know particularly a direct cause, and is there any specific cure?
Great questions, and the answer are no and no. So, you know, we have no idea about direct causes, although there's really interesting work going on. And, you know, they think that hormones play a role, so potentially there's mixed signals being sent by hormones. They don't know if it's actually something with the uterine lining itself that's disordered that causes it to grow in new places. And so because we don't have any idea of the root causes of this problem, we also don't have any idea about how to treat it. And suppressing a woman's cycle is the only option we have tried. And like I said, that's a pretty imperfect treatment option. And then just going in and having surgery every 5 or 10, 15 years is really the only thing that can fix severe cases of endometriosis, is just clearing it all out and then letting it start growing back again.
Clara Moskowitz and Jen Schwartz are guests on the Jefferson Exchange, co-editors of Scientific American. We're talking about the special issue, Fertile Ground, the Long-Neglected Science of Female Reproductive Health. You're welcome to join us at 800-838-3760 on the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. About the lack of research into women's reproductive health issues, I'm wondering how much religion has had in suppressing that, since every religion I know of, except for Unitarians and Quakers, are sexist and focused on men and put women under male domination. And I don't know if you've looked into this.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's find out. Thank you for that, Anne. Jen, you want to take that?
Sure. And actually, in our introductory essay that Clara and I wrote, you know, to sort of introduce why we were doing this topic in the first place, you know, we start by saying that female reproductive health has frequently been wrapped up in politics and patriarchy. And of course, you know, that includes the way that religion has, of course, played a role in our understanding of this topic. It's that was really what the way we framed this whole thing was, that when the discussion of reproductive health is dominated by the political or social will to control it, gaps in the medical research get overshadowed. And so, you know, of course, that's the huge reason. And it's not just religion. I mean, you can look back where eugenics was a huge problem with birth control and trying to control who was able to procreate and who was not. I mean, this is wrapped up in so many social forces that we talk about those so much, and that we actually don't talk enough about the science that gets left behind.
I was not surprised to see that one of the articles in here rose to the top of your hits on the web about girls starting periods very young. So what do we know about that? What's going on?
I can jump in on that one if you want. I mean, this is a really interesting thing too. So basically, the average age of a girl getting her first period has been going down and down and down. It's currently age 12, but it used to be age 14 a century ago, and even later, earlier and earlier. And so doctors are noticing this. It's happening all over the place, but they really don't have a good handle on why, and they think there's a lot of complicated reasons why girls are just going through puberty so much younger. Obesity, the rise in obesity, they think is a huge correlator, because the body mass index affects hormone levels, which then affects when you start your period and when you start going through puberty. And there's also a big role being played, we think, by endocrine disruptors and pollutants and chemicals in our environment. And so doctors are just kind of beginning to look into this, but it's this new frontier for families who are dealing with this without a lot of answers. And basically, girls' bodies are going through a process that their minds haven't caught up with. You know, children are not advancing mentally any faster than they ever used to. And, you know, the teenage brain has to go through very set processes of maturation over a long time period, but they're being given the bodies of adults much sooner and having to face a lot of choices about how to navigate their lives without too much guidance.
Is this just a Western thing, Clara, or are the early periods happening all over the world?
They are happening all over the world, but yes, Western societies are having a higher prevalence of this. Like I said, with the obesity correlation, countries with, you know, larger rises in obesity are seeing this this effect more strongly, but we see it happening everywhere.
And you mentioned endocrine disruptors, which are used as pesticides, basically, right?
Right, and you know, they're coming in all different ways. I mean, there's also chemicals like BPA, you know, in plastics and cans, and they think that these things have a strong effect on us. But again, you know, the science is not solid enough to say where exactly all this exposure is coming in, how can we get rid of it, and exactly what is it doing to cause girls to go through puberty. We don't have those answers.
All right, so to 12 now, was 14, and still creeping downward. Let's move on to another issue in reproductive health, and a bit of an ouch here, Jen Schwartz. You described the pace of innovation in birth control as slothful. Would you take that out a little further?
Sure. So, you know, I've been really noticing the way that the IUD is discussed in our society right now, and for those who don't know, the IUD is the device that is inserted into the uterus to prevent pregnancy long-term. So they're called long-acting reversible contraceptives. And, you know, what's funny is that we really tout these devices as sort of the best form for many women. They're highly effective. And, you know, sometimes people talk about them and say, set it and forget it. You just put it in and, you know, for 3 to 10 years, you have this device. But the reality is that it's a lot more complicated than that. And even though these devices work very well for many women, there are many women for whom they do not work well for. And there are still lots of side effects and adverse effects that are a huge trade-off when you're looking at these devices are not meant to treat a disease. And they're, you know, going into healthy young women a lot of the time. And so what are the trade-offs that we, you know, should be putting up with? And why don't we have more innovation on birth control? You know, IUDs were actually around before the pill itself. We've been putting devices, you know, in the uterus to basically create somewhat of an inflammatory environment. And that's what prevents sperm from being able to fertilize an egg. And so when you look at the history of why we don't have more innovation on birth control, not just for women, but for men as well, or for looking at birth control between, you know, the responsibility being shared between a couple or two different people. And there's very little that's been done in this realm. Male contraception, as a lot of us know, has been discussed, but there's been so many roadblocks, a lack of funding and interest from the pharmaceutical industry, some, you know, cultural pushback. But there's a lot of interesting research, but we haven't gotten very far in really pursuing innovative forms of birth control.
I want to move on to the issue of maternal mortality, and Clara, you say the blame often falls on the women?
Exactly. I mean, you know, we have seen worldwide maternal mortality actually declining. That's a good thing, but in the U.S. it's going up, and, you know, doctors in the U.S. are saying the reason that more women are dying in childbirth is because more women are overweight, more women have diabetes, and more women are deciding to have children at later ages. So they're basically putting the blame on the women themselves and saying that's driving this trend. But the problem, as we show in our issue, is that many, many other countries are seeing those same demographic changes in terms of age and obesity and diabetes and are not seeing the huge increase that the U.S. is seeing in how many women are dying. And research is actually showing that there's a lot of preventable things that you can take care of that don't have to do with fixing the underlying causes like age and weight. And it basically boils down to treating women fairly, listening to them when they're trying to report a problem, and just having standard toolkits in place to deal with problems that come up. And one of the hugest problems here, especially in the U.S., is racial disparities. So black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth than women of other races, and that's just completely inexcusable, and that's something that cannot be blamed on the women, and it's, you know, it's partly boiling down to racism in among healthcare providers and women having lack of healthcare available to them.
That was not a percentage more. It was 3 to 4 times more likely to die if you're an African-American?
3 to 4 times more likely to die from a pregnancy-related condition.
So, Clara, Scientific American has been down this road before. There was an editorial 2 years ago about ending the war on women's health. Do you sometimes feel like you're shouting into the darkness?
Yes. Yes, we do. But we also feel like, you know, I personally hear these conversations come up a lot more now than they ever did. And we feel that we're doing our part to put these issues out there and to put the data behind some of the discussions that people are having and to show that in some cases, like maternal mortality, science does have answers. You know, some states are much better than others at dealing with this problem, which shows that there are good things to be done, and we can use evidence-based methods to try to deal with these problems. But, you know, in general, we're dealing with a society that still is not anywhere close to where it needs to be in terms of treating women as full people, treating their medical problems seriously, and devoting the time and the money to research funding to study what's going on with them.
Okay, so clearly a long road ahead, but some major steps perhaps taken with this issue. Scientific American called Fertile Ground, the long-neglected science of female reproductive health. Clara Moskowitz and Jen Schwartz are the co-editors of Scientific American, and it's an issue with a lot of impact. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.